This is the Aftermarket Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone, to yet another episode of Diagnosing the Aftermarket A to Z. I'm Matt Fonslow, and you're not. But today, I have the distinct pleasure of bringing on kind of the main guy, or at least one of the main guys with Lock Labs. And we want to talk about this really under-discussed topic. We're just not seeing nearly enough going-ons in social media. Nobody seems to be talking about this. The NASDAQ and vehicle security professional credentials. If you've been following social media, I'm full of it. It's exploded. Really interested to hear the take from somebody from the equipment side, the aftermarket equipment side. So please welcome Mo Ali, or is it Mo Ali?
Yes, my mom, it's Ali. But, you know, we have, you know, a famous boxer that has that same last name. And it was more of an Ali than an Ali, but I'll take either. I've been called much worse things in my life than the mispronunciation of my last name. So, but I got to say, huge honor to be on your podcast. I've been a fan. I think I told you that when I met you. I really think that you provide a great service for people that need information or need better understanding of their tools and the things that happen in the background in the automotive repair sector. It's a highly underserved community there, and you're doing great work. And again, honored to be here.
Really, really appreciate that. Before we get rolling here, let's take a moment to hear from our sponsor, Napa Auto Tech Training. Napa Auto Tech offers 3-hour virtual technical classes that can be accessed from the comfort of your home. To find out what courses are available, go to NapaAutoTech.com and click on the Napa Auto Tech class calendar link. All right. So I don't know if you've heard about this entity called NASDAQ, the National Automotive Service Task Force. About a month ago, I had Donnie Cypher on, and this was before it really exploded. This is before we really saw, I guess, the letter come out saying this is going to happen. So it was somewhat preemptive. At the time, I don't think Donnie thought this was going to happen when it did. But now, I think very maybe oversimplified is to access the immobilizer type functions on now many aftermarket tools available to us. We require a credential or vehicle security professional. Would we call it a license? It used to be called the locksmith ID, but it's been switched to vehicle security professional. And it's kind of it really is a credential. You have to have a background check. You have to have proper insurance, and you get this through NASDAQ. And that gives us the ability to access functions the manufacturer doesn't want just anybody to have access to.
That's a pretty good summary of what is going to be expected out of those who seek to utilize a diagnostic machine to interface an immobilizer function on a vehicle. The platform that NASDAQ, well, it wasn't actually created by NASDAQ. It was actually created by us in the locksmith industry, specifically by Aloha, who is the trade organization for the locksmith industry. But the SDRM, which is the secure data release model, is essentially I don't want to say gateway, but I refer to it as a protocol that has a few different components. But the portion that impacts us is the manner in which SDRM governs or will govern our tools, as intended by NASDAQ, to create a scenario, like you said, where you have to validate not only the person behind the machine who intends to make a key for a car, but then you're also validating the vehicle itself by running the VIN to ensure that you're not about to make a key for a stolen vehicle. Or I don't know if it extends beyond just stolen, if there's like a lien on the title or something, if that's a red flag. But that's the gist of it, is making sure that the right person is making a key to an authorized vehicle.
And has a few people upset. Very, very, very upset.
In my industry particularly, which is the automotive locksmith industry, it's This is huge. In the repair sector, it's probably not as big of a shock to the system. And there are a few reasons for that. I think a lot of shops that do any sort of work that involves security modules, which is basically half the car nowadays, seems like every module has a security function or a diagnostic or a, I'm sorry, an emissions function. But, you know, that would just be a portion of the work that a repair shop would do. Whereas in our industry, it's 100% of the work. So there are a few problems that arise when an initiative like SCRM is proposed. And the biggest one initially was when NASA first started rolling out the verbiage for what they plan to deploy, it was stated that every machine, every programmer would need to have an online requirement, had to be online at all times in order for that transaction to happen to validate the locksmith and then validate the vehicle. And anybody that knows anything about cellular internet in this country, everything between LA and DC pretty much is crap. And even for me, I live in what I consider to be a decent enough area in California. And halfway to my kid's school, I completely drop signal for miles. I mean, and then you talk about situations where even if you are in an area that has good signal, well, what if you have to go into a parking garage? Or what if you're between a couple tall buildings? Or what if you're around a large number of people? Because the cellular networks can only handle so much traffic at once. So I don't know if you've ever been to like a concert and you can't quite get the signal that you should because everyone else is trying to utilize a finite resource. So yeah, that was something that I addressed early on when I got pulled into this, because that certainly was a deal breaker. There was no way we'd be able to comply with that as an industry. Just impossible. Fortunately for us, for the industry, that point abundantly clear to Donnie, and he listened, which was, I guess, unexpected at the time because I didn't know the guy initially. But now, as I've gotten to know him over the course of the last year, it's par for the course with him. He's definitely concerned about, well, anything you bring up. He's a good listener. He's understanding. So I've been grateful to be given a platform to be put in a position where, you know, I can advocate for our trade and for our machines and for our locksmiths. And he's been very receptive to all of that.
I would concur greatly. When I don't talk to him a lot, but when I have, especially with a concern, he's a very good active listener, gets the gist of what you're after. And then I just feel like he's attempts to make things right, whatever that may be. And it may not be able to help on that very specific vehicle at that very specific time, but it seems like things get put in motion that for the next vehicle, things go differently. That means the world. You feel like you've got good people in the right positions to help make our lives easier, even though arguably there's hoops to jump through to get to that ease rather than just buying whatever tool, plugging it in and having it work. Now there's some hoop jumping to be able to access those functions and use them. But I just have a feeling that was going to happen regardless. NASDAQ is just kind of the middle liaison between the manufacturers and the tool manufacturers, if you will. They are going to do whatever they can to try to shut things down. And the tool manufacturers, some of them are going to either try to buy that data or they're going to try to engineer their way around it. And it's just going to be this back and forth, where maybe now, maybe it doesn't have to be that way, at least for those of us that get the credential.
There are so many moving parts to that scenario. I don't know if people quite have an appreciation for the level of complexity that exists in what you're discussing in facilitating that transaction, that information from the OEs and getting it onto aftermarket tools. It's funny to me, because, you know, I've now been involved with the AutoProPad for over a decade now. Well, I shouldn't say that. It was released in 2016, but we had some time in research and development leading up to its release. So yeah, getting pretty close to 10 years here.
Those of you that have never heard of AutoProPad, you might call it a locksmith tool, but really it's a key programmer. It looks like a scan tool, in many cases behaves very much like a scan tool, but has advanced immobilizer functions specifically for either adding keys or what you would call an all keys lost situation, where you're basically saying to the car, hey, trust me, I'm going to show you a key or two or three or however many. These keys you should believe should be able to start the car. That's really the down to the brass tacks of what they do, is put the car into a registration mode or a learning mode. And it's, trust me, I'm telling you these keys should be allowed to start you. And there you go. And that's an AutoPro pad, I would say, is one of the very, very top. I know Mo's sitting here on the show, but if you've been to any of the key programming or cutting classes I've put on at Vision or heard me talk about tools to get to do immobilizer work or key work, the AutoPro pad is always listed at the very, very top of the list. And that's no BS. It's the real deal. Terrific tool. And one of those that if you're going to be doing key cutting and programming, it's must have along with a few others. It's going to do things the others don't, and vice versa, just like scan tools. But it's been a terrific, terrific addition to my arsenal. For many car lines, it is the first grab.
I definitely appreciate your kind words. And I know for a fact that a lot of locksmiths, probably all of them that are listening, probably moaning a little bit right now because, you know, to them, like, key programming should only be done by locksmiths. And I can't say I don't agree, but my rationale may be different than theirs. For me, it's about it's a specialized skill set. And I'm sure you run into limitations when you need to make a key, because there are certain things that you have to spend time researching and practicing. And, you know, so there'll be a ceiling for you unless you decide you're going to go fully commit and take the classes and get the proper education so you can make sure you're doing the right things the right way. For me, that's why there should be a barrier to entry with key programming tools. But I also understand that key making is not exclusive to locksmiths, because, I mean, what is a locksmith anyway? There's only 13 states in the US that have any sort of licensing laws. So you have to actually go through a process in order to get that title as of locksmith, whether it's through testing or simple background checks. Like in the state of California where I live, you basically give the government like $500 and you pee in a cup, and they run a background check, and they say, okay, you can put locksmith on your business card now. But if you're a handyman, or you know, and you have a general understanding of how to pin up a doorknob or something, and you put locksmith on your business card, I mean, does that make you any more or less legitimate than somebody that specializes? I mean, these are things that we could kind of debate all day, but I do recognize that, you know, key cutting, maybe not the key programming now anymore. Of course, things are changing, but there are definitely other industries that need to be able to support that. But, and that's a complicated position, especially for me, because, you know, as a manufacturer, sometimes, you know, I may not be in full alignment as the locksmith industry advocate, which is primarily where my heart is. My closest friends are locksmiths. This machine, you know, everything I've committed the last decade of my life to either distribution or manufacturing to support that industry. But I feel like there's obviously now with what's happening with NASTIF, I mean, maybe these conversations just don't even matter anymore, because it feels to me we'll be forced as far as how this industry is going to have to realign itself. And a big part of that is, you know, if everything that NASTIF is proposing goes into effect, which, if I'm being honest, I'm pretty confident that it will, and I can support that if need be, you know, we stand to lose. And now Donnie and I are kind of at odds on the exact number, but, you know, I feel like it's closer to half. He feels like it's closer to a third. I have pretty good line of sight with the number of like illegitimate key makers in this country, and that's a huge problem. We're talking about like scammers, like bait and switch type people that, you know, take advantage of Americans, consumers. But if that was to happen, and we lost even a third at where Donnie sits. Like, this is, he's his number. I mean, that's a third of all of America's key making needs that will go unfulfilled potentially. So someone's going to pick up that slack. And I don't see, as far as like the core of automotive locksmithing, which I consider to be in, like an emergency type service, you know, where you've lost your keys or, you know, you've locked them in your car and, you know, it's just whatever the same level as like a AAA type service, you know, emergency, roadside, whatever. I don't foresee any other industry stepping in to fill that role because, well, if they wanted to do it, they'd do it now. They'd have done it already. You don't see the OEs running 24-hour a day, 7-day a week key making services, and repair shops certainly don't, or I should say most often don't. I know some that do. Usually it's because they're in a rural area and there isn't an automotive locksmith and they just kind of had to do it. But overwhelmingly, that's our deal. And that service is so critical to the OE manufacturers, the vehicle manufacturers, as part of their customer satisfaction index. Because if an automaker creates a situation where somebody's loved one is unable to get the assistance they need at a critical moment, you know, lost the keys in a bad area, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Let's not ask what that person was doing in a bad area at 2 a.m., but, you know, things happen. And if I found out, for example, like that was my kid in that situation and they couldn't get the help that has been a standard for so long in roadside key making, and I found out that the automaker was responsible for it, that's the last car I'd buy from that automaker. That's it. I mean, you're making it so I can't drive my car just because I screwed up and lost something that is fits in the palm of my hand. You know, I don't know, man. There's a balance that needs to be achieved here, because once this thing does roll out and there are that many key makers gone, right, then the American public is going to be asking questions. Like, so I don't know. I guess that's just a side quest I went on there unnecessarily, but you'll get used to that with me.
For 98 years, the NAPA name has meant quality parts and service. It also reflects top quality training programs to help you build a more successful vehicle repair business. No doubt, the technician shortage is impacting everyone, but you're not facing this battle alone. NAPA has the solution by making NAPA AutoTech training available near you. NAPA AutoTech provides automotive aftermarket technicians career development opportunities through structured, disciplined, measured, and high-quality technical instruction, no matter the technician or service advisor skill level. This instruction enhances understanding of vehicle systems, increases first-time repair capability, and overall customer satisfaction. It also prepares technicians to become ASE certified. It's a fact, technicians who receive training to improve their knowledge and skills have a higher sense of job satisfaction. This reduces technician turnover and increases productivity, directly improving a shop's profitability. It is vital to the success of a shop's business that today's technicians are equipped to diagnose and repair today's complex vehicles. With our ever-changing technology, the technician's knowledge and skills need to be updated and refreshed on a regular basis. As you labor over the decision of whether to send your techs to get their skills sharpened, keep in mind, NAPA AutoTech training is an investment, not an expense, and it's available to all. Much of NAPA AutoTech's training is offered in more than one format to accommodate varieties of learning styles and training preferences so each person can maximize their learning. Whether you're more of a hands-on person or enjoy learning at your own pace, NAPA AutoTech is here to provide you with the training you need in the format that works best for you. To learn more about what NAPA AutoTech offers, contact NapaAutoTech.com. And not overly important, but the way I got into it was I was already doing keys, but I would get the keys from the dealer, and they're pre-cut, but they're not coded or anything. They're not ready to start the car. And then I would use the factory scan tool to add the key. One day I went to do it with a Ford with IDS, the factory scan tool, and it asked for some credentials that I didn't have. And of course I had to kick that car down the road to the dealer, because where I live and where the shop is, there's two locksmiths and neither of them have any interest in dealing with cars. They used to, they're fed up with it. And some days I don't blame them one bit. That's how it started. Then I got my VSP, which was called an LSID at the time. And then that allowed me to do specifically forward keys because that was the only one I knew of that was asking it. But then when I got my factory Volkswagen Audi scan tool, it needed my VSP credentials to even get it, to even get the tool. I mean, that's really how it started. And then I got sick of waiting to buy keys or going to a hardware store to have keys cut in certain situations. So I looked into getting a key cutting machine. And before I got any of that stuff, I went to those two locksmiths and I asked them if it was okay. Like, I didn't want to elbow my end in on their market, that I had a very specific purpose for doing this. And really, they just asked, do you have any intentions of doing anything outside of automotive, residential, commercial? And I said, hell no. I want nothing to do with that. And not only did they give me their blessing, in some cases, they sold me some of their stuff really, really cheap. So that was my entry into key cutting and programming, and then finding out about the AutoPropad and how I could do things much, much faster without the factory scan tool. And then some scan tools, even Snap-on would offer some key programming without credentials or anything, limited car lines, but it would do it. Yeah, it just opened up a whole new world. That's immobilizer keys and all that. It's just a whole nother world of automotive, almost like ADOS. It's just like their own terminology, different equipment needed to do it. It's just mind-blowing some days how much crap we got to know.
You bring up a good point. If anybody's qualified, you know, to be like the next in line, who I feel is okay to make keys for cars outside of locksmiths, it's got to be somebody with a functional knowledge of OE level diagnostics, because, you know, that is such a critical component to the entire process. And yeah, so in the repair sector, and again, I'll be at odds with most locksmiths, it just doesn't bother me as much. But where I'm in alignment with them is, you know, the fly-by-night person that wants to go and buy the cheapest key cutter and the cheapest key programmer they can buy off of Amazon or something, and go and cross their fingers and just start smashing buttons until something happens. Like, clearly, you know, that should never have been a scenario. And then I also agree that places like car dealerships, auction yards, you know, places that have automotive key making needs, I know some places try to do that stuff on their own. They'll have a locksmith and they'll try and cut them out and do it. And I just feel like we're talking about situations like that where this trade, our trade needs. I've got friends who, if not for their dealership and auction work, they wouldn't make it. You know, it gives them the highest concentration of work in one spot, right? Rather than waiting for a call and driving all around town, you know, maybe doing three, maybe four keys in a day, they can do 15, 20. I got a buddy that'll do 30, 35 a day. And so we need to make sure there's enough left there for us, because we really need to thrive in order to continue providing a service that Americans need and depend on. So for those reasons, I'm not okay with people trying to color outside of the lines. But a lot of my opinion about, you know, who can and cannot, or should and should not make keys, is kind of being influenced now by what's happening with NASDAQ and with SDRM, because with even a third of the key makers gone, someone's going to have to step up and at least be the place that you can provide a solution for key duplications, for example. So we're not cutting into the all keys lost thing. And well, again, like I said earlier, no repair shop, whatever. If they wanted to do it, they'd have done it already. But in order to meet the needs, the key making needs of Americans, I think that's probably what's going to end up happening, because it just makes the most amount of sense, right? People that know how to use these machines, they know what an OBD port is, they have some level of competence with diagnostics. It just makes the most amount of sense. I don't know. This is my prediction, is that things will go in that direction. And because they got to go somewhere, we're not going to make new NASDAQ credentialed locksmiths. And even if we were to do that, it's going to take time to get people trained and mobilized and whatnot. So one of the better aspects of all this is the companies that are able to get their papers in order and continue doing the work that they're already doing, like legitimate above board locksmith businesses, they should thrive in this new environment. They should have more work than they know what to do with. All their competition, but a lot of it is going to be gone. And that's a great thing. It's also a scary thing. In distribution, like, I have to look at things like our supply chain. Our current supply chain is set up to accommodate the current key making needs of Americans. And a lot of that, it's not catering, it's like geared towards enabling a scammer, but they are part of the ecosystem. I know a lot of legitimate, good, educated, well-versed, competent locksmiths that were forced out of business because scammers just came into their area and cannibalized all the key making, and they just couldn't compete. And if it's not a scammer that creeps in, then it's like Google trying to do something with their business listings to make their search results, to bury them or make them undesirable, or it's Yelp, or it's a service provider. There's always something. I swear to God, when I first got into distribution, I would hear it from the locksmiths. You know, there's always something that someone's trying to take food off the table. You know, there's always somebody trying to screw us up. Initially, it was like, I mean, these guys are paranoid. And I say these guys, I was an automotive locksmith as well prior to my tenure in distribution. But much like all the other automotive locksmiths, I was a single person. I didn't have coworkers driving around with me. There was no culture, right? There's one person in a van. But yeah, it wasn't until I started attending trade shows and stuff and getting around these guys in groups that, you know, I could get to hear the narratives. And initially thought they were paranoid. And I learned very quickly, no, they're absolutely right. It does feel like that. You know, everyone's trying to take a slice of that pie. And I know for a fact, this NASA thing feels no different to probably most of them. Like, here we go again, right? What's NASA going to do now? You know, how much are we going to have to pay them? And it's a racket and it's a shakedown. I'm hearing all that rhetoric. I've been talking to Don. Donnie's well aware of all of this, as I make sure I put it in front of him. Without giving away too much, because, you know, we are, again, I'm working with him to try and get some level of advocacy and understanding. And I'll say compassion here. He's got a couple of things. We've cooked up a couple of things that I think are going to mean a lot to the locksmiths. And I'll give him a little time to operate, and he'll probably announce something here pretty soon.
NASTF's not as big as people think. I think they have this idea that it's just this monster government agency. It's not related to the government at all. I don't know that they even have 10 employees there.
Yeah, everyone thinks they're like the six-headed fire-breathing monster, and it's really just a bunch of nerds and car enthusiasts. And I say that with affection, because I'm definitely a nerd myself and a car enthusiast. It really is just a small group of guys that have been presented with this monumental task of reining in automotive security, and they're doing the best they can. And when I say it like that, it makes it sound like they've made a little bit of progress, and they've actually moved mountains, which is why you need good nerds on your team always, right? Yeah, they're not this conglomerate or entity of the US government. They have the backing of several federal agencies, and we're talking about like the FBI and NICB and a Department of Homeland Security and Border Patrol. And I think that might be it. I'm sure you've probably met Rusty. He's a former FBI agent. And I believe he was instrumental in when he was still working with the FBI, I believe he was instrumental in helping to kind of foster communication and to help out NASTF's efforts. And then Donnie snatched him up as soon as he became available, which is a good pick because Rusty's a good dude. But yeah, so there's like, you know, they're government adjacent for sure, but they are not by any means. They're a nonprofit. They're a trade organization, for crying out loud. You know, one of the largest in the nation, if I'm not mistaken.
At least for automotive techs, yeah.
Yeah, right.
And presumably eventually locksmiths, but automotive techs for sure.
Let's talk about that real quick, because again, I don't want to give away too much, especially when, you know, the ball's in Donnie's court right now for a lot of the things we've been kind of planning. But one of the first things that Donnie told me about NASTF was about that they are a trade organization. And I remember him specifically saying, yeah, but we don't have trade shows. I was like, okay, I mean, why not? And really also, you know, the locksmith industry, we're a trade without organization, period. We have, again, I said it's one person operations overwhelmingly, right? It's like one man in a van or woman, sorry, 2024. And so really, it's a bunch of independent people who all serve a common cause, but there is no real thread that kind of ties them all together. Now, I know this, it all sounds like I'm bashing Aloha, because there is that as an entity, a trade organization for locksmiths, but really Aloha only gave locksmiths a nod a couple years ago. I don't even know if it's been 2 years, with the creation of IAAL, which is the International Association of Automotive Locksmiths. But it's in its infancy. It's probably going to take a few years to be fully realized, if it does at all. Yeah, a lot of my conversations now with Donnie have been more, the essence is, you know, if while you're trying to pull us all closer to your organization, why don't you give us a home? Because clearly, if you want our goals to be aligned, there's got to be some level of desire there, right? It can't all just be enforcement. And he's been very receptive to that. So I'm excited to see what will become of that, because we need a barrier to entry. It doesn't exist currently, because as I mentioned, those licensing laws, they're non-existent, right? 13 states. And there's no credentialing program nationwide. I mean, a lot of people, I'm one of them, think there should be something like along the lines of an ASE type certification to really show Americans like that they're dealing with somebody that they can trust. Because unfortunately, because Aloha doesn't really serve the automotive locksmiths, or they're trying, like putting an Aloha accreditation on your business's website doesn't really hold much weight, especially in the automotive space. That's an opportunity for them, but wouldn't it be great to get that validity in a sector that we're in better alignment with? And what I mean by that is, you know, locksmiths, commercial and residential locksmiths, they're a different animal than the automotive guys. This is my observation. These are my observations, though. But yeah, I feel like they're more, the commercial locksmiths are more in that construction worker, contractor mindset. A lot of locksmiths are going to cringe hearing me say this, but you know, the automotive locksmiths are more in the mechanic kind of mindset. You know, they feel very similar. I know there's not a lot of respect. Well, I'm sure the mechanics don't even have a thought about automotive locksmiths outside of, oh, they exist, right?
It's kind of both ways, right? And I would throw in, it's also the same with like 12 volt installers, like accessory installers. Your thoughts of them is so skewed, because you only ever see it when the things go sideways. Some locksmith, or probably more likely a scammer, did some sort of work and made things worse. And now it's sitting in your bay and you're thinking, what are these locksmiths doing? Just, you know what? Stick to the tumblers, leave the electronics alone. However, there's a ton of extremely skilled, extremely smart locksmiths out there that do some extremely amazing work, as well as really, really high quality work. And you don't see any of those in your bay. Yet they also have a skewed view too of, oh, wow, one of these auto techs tried to do this job. They tried to add a key, or they watched a few YouTube videos and thought they could just EEPROM this thing. And now I've got this big mess on my hands. We're really being thrust together like never before. A lot of, because not even NASDAQ, I think this predates at least NASDAQ with this, the SDRM and all that, is the theft related parts. You had mentioned something earlier about people branching into other areas. And I think a lot of it's been forced. And locksmiths, I think, are being forced to think about doing mobile diagnostics, or more so maybe not diagnostics, but mobile programming, and be almost becoming mobile techs. Because if the locksmithing, pure locksmithing stuff is starting to get diluted by auto techs or whoever, they're already in the van. They already have a lot of equipment, like a lot of locksmiths running around with factory scan tools, J2534 devices that they're already doing close to programming, if not actual programming already. It would be nothing to add that service to their list of things that they could provide a shop, because maybe they do show up to help a shop out after a module replacement and there's an immobilizer function that needs to be ran. They do not have the capability. And that's kind of how the mobile techs got involved with a lot of the locksmith stuff, is they're showing up to program a new module. Well, okay, we'll pick on Ford. They replaced a powertrain control module. Not only does it need to be programmed, you have to add two keys. And maybe you don't have those keys. And now it's go to the dealer, go to a store that maybe cuts keys. Okay, well, now they're buying key cutting machines. And it's just starting to get kind of thrust together. Mobile techs, automotive mobile techs running into situations where they're taking on more key stuff. Well, now they're running into issues with NASDAQ and maybe they don't like the idea of VSP. So now they're into leashing and trying to kind of bypass getting key codes through the portals, through the websites. And then you have the brick and mortar techs like me who, especially I think it might be like regional, like where I'm specifically existing, that I have to deal with all of this. And so now I'm doing things outside of just auto repair. And it's just driven by, I think like you said very, very early on, so much on the vehicle is electronics and modules. And what does the manufacturer deem theft related? What's immobilizer related? And of course, powertrain control module makes sense. And of course, a body control module makes sense. And of course, an anti-theft module of some sort or immobilizer module of some sort. But now transmissions are in there, steering lock modules, what radios in some cases, like it just may keep expanding, probably will keep expanding. It's forcing our worlds together. That's the way I see it, is we're just being forced together and kind of diluting everything between each other, where I think locksmiths are going to find themselves taking on more pure programming, not showing up necessarily for an immobilizer or key situation. It's, hey, we replaced this radar. Can you program it? Yeah, I'll give it a whirl. They got the stuff to do it.
I know some brilliant, brilliant locksmiths. I mean, I've got friends that can, you know, field strip a vehicle, you know, with a set of hand tools and pull out every single module and crack open the cases and pull information and rewrite it to the boards in this coordinated effort to just to make a single key. I mean, sometimes it is that complicated, especially when you're looking at European vehicles, which is just a whole different animal, not just in locksmithing, but as you're well aware, and just pretty much every aspect of auto repair or work. But I do agree, as the vehicles are getting more complicated, that the processes to make these keys are getting more complicated. And they're not supposed to be, because there are protections in place that are supposed to make key making easy, really. I mean, simple. And I can get specific with code if everyone wants to take a nap. I can give you some snippets. If you look at EPA regulation 40 CFR, it's Charlie Frank, what's the phonetic R? Robert? 8 Romeo. So CFR 86.1808-01. It's an EPA regulation. It's law passed by Congress, I think in 2000, I want to say 3, but I could be wrong. August 26th, 2003. And this is given to me by Donnie, by the way. We haven't even talked about my tool, right? But by remaining close to the situation, like, you know, I'm getting the information that I need in order to make a decision about what we're going to do with our tool. But see, today's action finalizes a provision that requires OEMs to make available to any person engaged in the repairing of services or servicing of motor vehicles or engines all information necessary to make use of the OBD systems and any information for making emission-related repairs, including any emissions-related information that is provided by the OEM to franchise dealers. The information includes the following. Now, I lose people here because when I say EPA, they go, how does that affect us? Well, let's dig in. So the list, and I'll try and just abbreviate because I got to get down to bullets 11 and 12. Manuals and technical, or TSBs, as you guys know them, diagrams and charts. So this is a list of stuff, right, that the OEs are supposed to provide. a general description of the operation of each monitor, including the parameters, a listing of all typical OBD DTCs, a description of the typical enabling conditions for each monitor during vehicle operation, a listing of each monitor sequence, execution frequency, and typical duration, a listing of typical malfunction thresholds for each monitor, it gets into OBD parameters, identification and scaling, information related to the service, repair, installation, or replacement of parts or systems developed by third-party suppliers for OEs, information, other systems that could directly affect the emissions systems in a vehicle, and any information regarding system component or part of a vehicle monitored by the OBD system. And then these last two bullets, I'm just going to read them verbatim. So I'm in, what is this, section 2A, bullet 12. Any other information relevant to the diagnosis and completion of an emissions-related repair. This information includes, but is not limited to, information needed to start the vehicle when the vehicle is equipped with an anti-theft or similar system that disables the engine. This information also includes any OEM-specific emissions-related diagnostic trouble codes, DTCs, and any related service bulletins, troubleshooting guides, and or repair procedures associated with these OEM-specific DTCs. Bullet 13, OEMs shall make available computer or anti-theft system initialization information necessary for the proper installation of onboard computers on motor vehicles that employ integral vehicle security systems or the repair or replacement of any other emission-related part. So yes, the immobilizer has now been classified as an emissions-related part because it governs the starting of the vehicle. OEMs are not required to make this information available on the OEM's website unless they choose to do so. However, the OEM's website shall contain information on alternate means for obtaining the information and or ability to perform reinitialization. Beginning with the 2008 model year, we require that all OEM systems will be designed in such a way that no special tools or processes will be necessary to perform reinitialization. In other words, EPA expects that the reinitialization of vehicles can be completed with generic aftermarket tools, like the AutoPropad, a pass-through device, like a J-Box, or an inexpensive OEM-specific cable. Never seen one of those. This model year cutoff is consistent with the requirement to complete the phase-in of the SAE J2284-3 CAN requirement as discussed in Section 18, blah, blah, blah. So there it is. Like, if we're looking for a good smoking gun, and this is passed by Congress, by the way, right? This is already a law. We are legally protected in the work that we do. And if the OEs won't give us the information, we're allowed to acquire it. But wouldn't it be great if they just gave it to us? And I would take it with their oversight and their guidelines and respect the hell out of all of it. But things sit right now, we kind of get into another very interesting scenario. So you're friends with Keith.
Keith Perkins?
Yeah.
I think he's still talking to me, yeah.
So Keith Perkins, he's on the NASDAQ board. And I've gotten to know him pretty well over the last couple of months. He's a really intelligent, really great guy. A very interesting story.
The guy jumps out of perfectly good airplanes. All right. Let's just qualify him. You're right on all accounts.
And actually, all the best locksmiths I know have all taken his course that he teaches module work and I think 60 other classes at his L1 Academy. So there's a plug for you, Keith. But I was talking to him about aftermarket tools and the work that NASIF does in order to get that information from the OEs to the aftermarkets. And we found out that he and I have completely different definitions of aftermarket. For him and for NASIF, they consider it a win when a maker, an automaker, creates a portal on a website that gives a laptop access through a J-Box in order to make a key for a vehicle. Even when that process includes having to pay for a subscription or pay per transaction, or requires you to have to buy a separate laptop because all the automakers don't want other people, you know, Ford doesn't want you getting their data dirty with a Toyota data, you know, on the same hard drive. Like, you know, it's frightening for them or something. But they consider that a win when they're able to facilitate that transaction. But that's not what I consider to be aftermarket, because you're still relying on the OE for the transaction, the data, for all of it. And you have to be online for the most part. These are deal breakers for a lot of locksmiths. The online thing is an immediate deal breaker, because how can you, when there's no signal, how can you make a key, right? But then all the others, the costs involved, you know, there's only so much that you can charge for a key make. And if you have to go and buy a laptop and a Kardec 3 or something, I mean, you're in several thousand, I shouldn't even say several, you're in tens of thousands of dollars in equipment just to be able to service all the makers. And that only gets you like a system or, you know, whatever, like you need a laptop for every iteration. If they put out a different security protocol, now you got to go and isolate that one or whatever. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It might make sense to a single automaker who's not considering the larger market space and that they do have competition, and that a locksmith may need to secure all of the tools for every maker. They think that they did a good job because they allowed one thing to happen, right? Not considering the totality of it. So yeah, it's for me, when I think aftermarket, I think of like the Auto Pro Pad. The data is on the tool. It does not need to go online in order to make a key. And it doesn't nickel and dime you. And really, who wins? Yeah, sure, the locksmith wins, because it keeps their costs down. It keeps them efficient. You know, they can move from vehicle to vehicle and not get stuck just trying to put in a AC Delco password or something. But the customer wins, Americans win, because it keeps the cost of that service down. Could you imagine having to fork out $600, $700, $800 because you freaking drop your keys? Like, you know, I mean, what is that? That's a hardship. It's so complicated, and there's a lot of angles that, you know, we really need to be thought through. And I'll say it before and I'll say it again, I'm grateful to now be in a position where I can bring those things to light to the person that matters the most. So far, again, like, we'll see, because I'm still trying to learn and gain an understanding, but it seems like people are listening. So I'm optimistic for my trade.
Me too. What did the locksmiths feel or think about NASDAQ and these credentials? How is that affecting them?
My stances, again, don't always align with the locksmith industry, because I am out here trying to build bridges. So I can vocalize that the locksmiths may not think very highly of mechanics or anybody else in the repair sector, you know, taking over their industry, which is what a lot of people think. But again, because I believe that that sector will need to pick up the slack when all the bad actors are kind of forced out. And I'm hoping they just stay in their key duplication lane, which makes the most amount of sense to me. Would never want to speak in any terms that would be off-putting to any other industry, because why would I do that? We're looking to be accepted. It sounds corny. We want to be seen or whatever. But really, yeah, I think that's true. Like, respect, we don't have any right now, it feels. Anyway, that aside, to your question then, the disconnect that exists, it's huge. So the way things are set up now, you could be an automotive locksmith, a perfectly good, legitimate, competent, skilled automotive locksmith, and have absolutely no interaction with the NASDAQ whatsoever. In fact, it's probably the case for most automotive locksmiths. They don't even have a membership or subscription or credentials or whatever you want to call it, because they don't need it. We've figured out a way around all of it. And that's not entirely, it wasn't because we decided we were going to. I feel like a lot of it has to do with NASDAQ's actions. And Donnie will be the first to tell you, you know, about his, you know, historically, the challenges that NASDAQ has faced. When we were talking about in eras that predate him, because he is a quite competent fellow. But I do recall kind of some of the previous people that were running the show. And yeah, he's not that. So the SRM platform was created by the locksmith industry, handed over to NASDAQ for whatever reason. That's a whole other story there. And then for years and years, from NASDAQ's conception, I want to say around maybe 2014 or so, the registry was almost exclusively locksmiths. As the automotive security evolved, you know, as the automakers started to dump more electronics in these vehicles, then we began to see a shift. Somewhere in that 2014, 2015 era, and where then the number of people in the repair sector like eclipsed the locksmiths. I mean, dwarfed, really. And so obviously then you it's a numbers game at that point, and you shift your attention to where it's needed, and it's to serve the larger percentage, right? So really, NASDAQ had nothing to offer the locksmith industry outside of the incorrect, in my assertion, aftermarket definition, right? The expensive, costly, time-consuming way, still utilizing the OEs. It wasn't even there on their radar to provide immobilizer data to a tool like mine or the others that do the same work. And then as far as key codes go, you know, the funny thing about having, or if in the locksmith culture, if you have NASDIF, that means you're either A, an extremely competent and skilled, highly skilled locksmith who does the module work, and you need an LSAD, well now a VSP, just to even go and buy the parts sometimes, like for Mercedes. Or you are a hack and you suck at your job because you just pay for key codes all day instead of decoding the lock like a proper locksmith. And I happen to agree with that. And that prospect alone is contrarian to NASDAQ if you think about it. I mean, you don't have to think about it. We're not supposed to be decoding locks. We're supposed to be paying the OEs for key codes. But why would we do that? It's expensive and time consuming. It requires an internet connection. And, you know, there's no shortage of reasons. So really, NASDAQ just kind of dropped off the map for us. They stopped doing really much for the automotive locksmith industry. We were left to fend for ourselves. And so how do you acquire immobilizer data when the OEs are unwilling to give it to you? You get it by any means necessary. So they really force our trade underground. Once you're down there, you know, you got people showing up in trench coats and holding, you know, pulling open one side and going, hey, you want immobilizer data? You know, I got what you need. It's kind of frightening. And it's funny to me because it was such an inherent part of the locksmith culture, the whole anti-NASDAQ thing. Like, I couldn't even see it. And I was a toolmaker. And I'm talking back in the earlier days, a decade ago. But I remember I put out, and Donnie called me out on this when I first met him. And I didn't even freaking know. We had something in an AutoProPad ad or somewhere that said, no NASDAQ needed. You know, it was probably to just bypass some Ford programming timeout or something. You know, he was like appalled that I would choose that verbiage. And I'm looking at him going, I didn't know that was wrong. I'd like, you know, how was I supposed to know? You're not a presence for me in my day-to-day. Like, why am I meeting you now for the first time? Because things are going sideways. People are stealing cars. He didn't know at that time, like, how little line of sight I had with NASDAQ, which is actually none. And so, you know, this has been a learning process for me. Do I want to tell people publicly that we haven't made a decision about SDRM because I'm trying to get more information? I mean it. So does everyone else. So do the locksmiths. Like, they need more information in order to make the best decision for their businesses. I'm not doing anything different. I think that kind of sums it up. We had to go and do it our own way, and we don't have a governing body. So we just did what we could, and here we are. And, you know, I get some grief about the AutoProPad, even though now it's like really one of the least used tools for stealing cars, because we've put some protections in place with an online requirement. Although it's not as aggressive as NASDAQ's, it does need to touch the internet once a week. And if it does, and it's a stolen tool, then we'll brick it. If you don't let it touch the internet, it'll brick itself. But, you know, when we first put out the machine, it wasn't even a thought. Like, we didn't even think about, do we lock this down? Because the barrier to entry to making a key for a car wasn't the programmer. It was cutting a key. You can't steal a car if you don't know how to decode a lock or buy a key code. You know, the barrier to entry to decoding a lock is your skill set. And then the barrier to entry to buying a key code was NASDAQ. So we didn't change, the industry did. It went push to start. And then as soon as we started seeing the trend and started receiving those calls about, was your tool used? Can we tell if your tool was used in this crime? We immediately put the online requirement. It's about an aggressive a move as we could do with an over-the-air update at that time. So I'll tell you this much right now, the next AutoProPad, of course, it's going to be more secure. Of course it is. That's our duty to America. Every locksmith is also a vehicle owner. For most Americans, it's their largest investment, because, well, especially here in California, because no one can afford to buy a home. Yeah, I want to protect people's investments, and I don't want to think that we're responsible for someone's hard work and their prized possession getting taken out of their driveway. Like, what's that all? I can't even begin to think about what that would feel like if we didn't. Anyway,
that's a perspective we don't get. It's a really good one too.
It's so complicated. I don't think people appreciate how complicated this situation is. I've had so many conversations with so many different people about this subject, and something always comes up that blows my mind, you know, that I hadn't considered. When I talk to Donnie, it's a nonstop, like, you know, we're both kind of enlightening one another, you know, based on what we're hearing and what, you know, like I try to kind of bring him like those epiphanies, like in a nice compact package, so I don't waste too much of his time. And I'm quite pleased to hear him acknowledge, firstly, the stuff that he's already heard that's in alignment with what I'm telling him, which means I know he's engaged the right way. And then for him to acknowledge when I have enlightened him to something that he never even considered. It's been a very interesting experience for the two of us. You know, like there's a factor in reducing the number of vehicles stolen by a key programmer. Well, if you take all that away, the car thefts, sure, the numbers will probably drop. But then the means to acquire the vehicles that are stolen, like, what does that look like? Because I'm in California, again, I know what a carjacking is. So that's back on the table. So having the government involved in some way at some level is, it's critical, because just that angle alone, you know, law enforcement needs to be, they need to be given the best information as quickly as possible so they know what to expect. As far as any level of government intervention in what we're dealing with through NASTIF, no. For me, I don't want, that is just the worst. Yeah, that's a worst case scenario. And that's one of those things too, I tell people, like, if we don't work this out with NASTIF and figure out how we're going to be better players in the security space, then the government's just going to step in and kick both us and NASTIF to the curb and figure it out for us. And we all know how that story ends. Yeah, no thank you on that front. I can't speak for Donnie, but I'd imagine he's probably in agreement with that sentiment. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's part of the reason NASTIF exists. It's how ASE came into being. We all know how that goes when the government really gets involved and dictates how things are going to go. It just goes to hell in a handbasket. So if we can do what we can on our end for at least the protocols, and then if the government's involved just enough to give certain things a little bit of teeth, then we're good.
Yeah, I believe we need some measure of governance for sure. From a trade perspective, we can never be unionized because we're a collection of independent workers, nor do I feel a lot of people would want to. That's a whole other can of worms. Let's not talk about unions today. But, you know, it's funny. You're sitting here talking to me, the tool manufacturer, and I'm talking about advocacy. Why? Why is that? It's because in our industry, because we don't have a trade organization, you know, we have, I guess, the top of the food chain in our, for our industry are the distributors and the manufacturers. It's interesting to see how that works, because that's a tough position, because on one hand, you clearly, as a distributor, your primary concern is the business and making sure that, you know, you're remaining profitable and, you know, doing things the right way. But then, well, I guess it doesn't really put you at odds with the locksmiths with advocacy, because if you're supporting them, then you're hopefully ensuring that they thrive. So yeah, it's in alignment. For those who are willing, you'll thrust this into the spotlight. So we've got people like my good friend Mike Kennedy with American Key Supply currently. He's one of the loudest voices in locksmith advocacy. In fact, I take a lot of my cues from him. He was a competitor, where he was working for a different distributor at the time. There's a camaraderie there between me and him, and actually a lot of the distributors, we did have some working relationships with one another back, we're talking, you know, last decade. But as soon as he became available, I was like, no, you need, I was American Key Supply's vice president at the time. It's like, you need to come, because he's, his energy level, his compassion, his empathy, you know, people like him for a reason. And I look up to him, not just because he's 7 feet tall, but really, like, he's been an inspiration for me. And then also the owner of American Key Supply, Kerry, from day one, it was do what's right for the locksmith, right? And he would say, do what's right for the locksmith and the business will come. Still says it to this day. That's what I came up around. So advocacy is just baked in from the beginning. It was like inherent. But now with this opportunity, well, it's not an opportunity. I guess I had to just turn it into one. I was given access because of my tool, because Donnie had questions about it. And this SCRM thing was happening. I remember the day I met Donnie. We met at it was a weekend of ETI, Tool Tech in New Mexico. This is like a little over a year ago now, right? Or maybe a year ago. And I knew he had asked me to come to talk about the AutoPro Pad because there's no other reason he would even know my name. I remember we talked about the AutoPro Pad for about 10 minutes. And then as I started to hear his plans for SCRM and the deployment, and I started to hear how it would impact my friends and their abilities to provide for their families, like from that moment and for that rest of that conversation, it was near 2 hours, I think, all I did was talk about what I thought could be done differently about the deployment. And he listened from the beginning. In fact, I don't know if he even remembers this. He did a keynote at the conference the next day. It was like the kickoff for Tool Tech. And he was actually paraphrasing parts of our conversation. I was like sitting in the back. I had like chills. Like, what's going on here? It's just so surreal, right? But he began listening right away, which I greatly appreciate and respect. So yeah, advocacy, the thrust into it, and I have no problem continuing down that path. And I would like to not do it alone, if anyone's listening. My friends are there for me, but you know, they're busy people. And there are other people that have some pull and some clout. I know a lot of people are scared because it's like, if you step up and you're a distributor or you're a manufacturer, like all of a sudden, are you now going to receive more scrutiny by NASTIF rather than hanging back? Yeah, probably, maybe. I mean, good or bad scrutiny, I don't know. But sure, now he knows, Donnie knows your name and who you are and what you do. But if we don't do these things, there may not be an industry to advocate for, which I don't think is true anymore. But at that moment in time, when I first met him, man, when I heard some of those proposals, I was like, this is going to spell the end. And I told all my friends, I'm like, whatever you're good at, whatever you're second best at, you might want to consider investing in that, you know, but that changed very quickly for me as I began to see the progress and the understanding and the change. When he first told me about SCRM, every vehicle had to be online. And then I explained all the different issues that would arise, which I did earlier today. And then I proposed an offline scenario. And he admitted they hadn't considered it. And then we sat there and I was trying to get it pushed up as high as it could go. I think I got it up to 3 hours or something, and it felt accomplished. And then next time I talked to him, I think he had it up to 5. And then out of nowhere, without me even saying anything, he on his own, he pushed it to 24, which tells me what he got it. Right. He thought about it. He asked. He probably did the research knowing him. Right. And he said, yeah, it can't just be a few hours. Right. Because there's going to be situations where, you know, maybe you're doing an auction, a yard or something, and you're there for 10 hours or something, which is a very realistic scenario. So what's that guy going to do? Seems fair so far.
Well, sir, I really, really appreciate you coming on.
I'm so grateful to be here. I really could talk to you all day, and maybe we could do this again as we kind of progress.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, man. Again, huge fan, and this is also surreal to me. I mean, who am I anyway, right? But I'm here with Matt Vanslow. Who knew? My mom's going to be so proud.
See, that you got it backwards, because I was telling everybody I was going to be on a podcast with Mo Ali, and here I am.
And then they canceled you. They're like, what, Mo? Yeah, forget it. Flagged by YouTube. It's over. Game over. Cool, man. Well, yeah, great talking to you, and we'll do it again soon.
Thank you again. Thanks everyone for listening. Thank you to Napa Auto Tech Training for sponsoring, and thank you to the Aftermarket Radio Network for making this all possible. As always, if you have ideas for the show or comments to make about the show, please don't hesitate to reach out to me on social media or email me at mattfonslowpodcast@gmail.com. And until next time, take care.
You've been listening to Matt Fonslow, diagnosing the aftermarket A to Z on the Aftermarket Radio Network. Follow Matt on your favorite listening app. He's very interested in what you have to say. Let him know what you'd like him to cover and come on the show. Matt is all for advancing the aftermarket. Find Matt Fonslow on social media and connect or on aftermarketradionetwork.com.